This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Ways to achieve the fulfillment of the desire for self-expression and for individuality, which is one of the very, very basic drives that every human being experiences. The will to see himself and experience himself as different from everybody else. The first one is through the process of selection. That is, that a person expresses his identity by the choices he makes. Really very simple. And that starts in early childhood. The moment the child is capable of making choices and making decisions, the child starts asserting his individuality through the decision-making process. He'll start off by just the ability to say no is in fact an expression of individuality. His first attempt to show that he is different and separate from the authority of his parents. So you'll say, do X, and he'll say no. It's not because he means no or because he means to be disobedient. We tried it with our child, and we said, go and wash your face, and she said no. We said, go and eat supper, and she said no. We said, have a little sweet, and she said no. It doesn't make no matter what you're telling her to do when she's in that mood, whatever you want her to do, she will express a no as a form of making a choice contrary to the choice you want her to make as a means of expressing the personality. As the child gets a little older, it moves into the area of choice of toys, what he's going to play with at a particular time, choice of activities, the games he's going to play, what he's going to be doing, the friends with whom he's going to be playing at any particular time. When he gets a little bit older, it starts going into the area of the choice of clothing, what he's going to wear, or particularly what she's going to wear and what she's not going to wear. And so the choice or the selection mechanism starts functioning, and the child builds up an image of his own individuality and personality which is different to other people's because of the sum total of choices that that child and later that adult has made. And in adulthood it goes into the area not only of the choice of objects and the choice of clothing and the choice of toys, but the choice of value systems. What I'm going to sacrifice in order to gain what? When the pressure's on, what I'm going to choose? Convenience or righteousness? Am I going to do that which is nice or that which is good? And if I'm going to do that which is good, what do I consider good? And so the choice mechanism again functions, whereby each individual develops and expresses himself as unique and different from other people. And not only is this an expression of his uniqueness, but ultimately it becomes a cause of his uniqueness too, because through his choices, he experiences different things. And if you take everybody's choices, you'll find that although many of them might be similar, there are no two individuals who throughout their life, in similar situations, have made identical choices. Right through. Each one's choices differ slightly one from the other in particular areas. And that's where the concept of people with different tastes comes, people with different value systems, people with different personalities, or perhaps really what we're looking for is people with different characters. And the choice of action is supposed to be an expression of character. What do you do when your house is burning down? What do you go and save? What do you run out and fetch? That's an expression of character. If you've only got a limited amount of money, what do you spend it on? Having things or doing things? That's an expression of character. And so on, as one goes through, the various choices of what one does and what one doesn't do are expressions of character. Particularly what one does and doesn't do when one's back is up against the wall. And yet, it's not really a valid test of uniqueness and a valid expression of individuality. Because you can find two people very different from one another, committing the same action for totally different reasons. So that not only is it not a valid expression of individuality and uniqueness, but it's not even really a guide to character. You can find an individual who does a most heroic act, The house is burning down and he doesn't even know who lives in the house, but he runs in and he saves the person and brings them out. Very heroically. That might be a tzaddik. Or it might be a giver. It might be a person who just likes doing heroic things because there were a whole lot of people standing outside and he enjoys the applause as he comes out of the burning house carrying the person whom he saved. Now those are two very different people. They've done the same thing. So those two people have done the same action. Both have run into a burning house at great danger to themselves in order to save a human being for totally different reasons. So you can't just say because they did it they are tzaddikim. Not necessarily so. One can do two people can do the identical thing. One can be a tzaddik and one can in fact be a rosha. He's doing it because he knows that in the house there's a very pretty young lady who's married to another man, and he's hoping that by saving her from the house he'll be able to get hold of her and marry her. That's what he's doing. So he's also done the same thing. He's saved the woman from the burning house. No tzaddik, that's a rosha. So there's no way you can look at a man's actions and say, ah, what a righteous man, what a tzaddik. Unless you really know what is motivating him. And the secret to a man's character lies not only in what he does or not in what he does at all, but in why he's doing it. What is pushing him to do it? The second area of expression of individuality, which is a more accurate one and a safer one, is the area of creativity. Not selection now, but creation. So if I select, that doesn't really tell you what I am. If I select to dress in orange trousers with a blue suit and a polka dot bow tie, that doesn't mean I'm necessarily that kind of person. It might mean I'm just trying to create an impression that I'm that kind of person, although I'm really not. When a person is making selections, he's in full control over the selections he's making, and he'll make the selections sometimes because those selections are genuinely him, and sometimes he'll make those selections because he wants to create a particular impression, although it's not him at all. That's how an actor operates, isn't that so, Hugh? Isn't that so? He deliberately chooses costumes and he chooses actions and he says things not because he's really that individual whom he's saying that he is, but because he wants to create the impression that he's that individual. And one doesn't only have to be on the stage to be an actor. Most people are acting in various situations in their lives, creating impressions. It doesn't mean that that's necessarily negative. Sometimes it's necessary to create certain impressions and one has to be sensitive to that. But that doesn't mean that therefore by the way you present yourself I can tell terribly much about you. I can't necessarily. When it comes to creation, yes. So I don't go to the shop and buy my orange trousers and my blue shirt and my polka dot tie, but instead I make it myself. I go and I get the material and I dye the material and I go through the whole thing myself and I produce my attractive suit of clothes I've just described to you. That now says a lot more about an individual. When it comes to the creative aspect of an individual, when it comes to his creativity and his creation, there it's very difficult not to express your personality and not to express your individuality. When you're making something from nothing, that something that you're making is being made by you and by nobody else. And it can't be imitated. Or let's say it can be imitated, but it can't be imitated and be creative at the same time. If you want to copy a Rembrandt, you can copy a Rembrandt, but that's not being creative. If you want to make your own Rembrandt, it won't look like the other one. It'll look a little bit different. So it's not possible to mass produce something which has been created, something which has been made from nothing. It's not possible to mass produce it. It's not possible to copy it. Even the same person cannot copy it twice. It's not possible for me to give you the same shear twice. Impossible. No matter how well I know the shear, I would never be able to repeat it in such a way where it's exactly the same as the time before. It's not possible for an orchestra to play a piece of music twice the same way. Each time there are going to be slight differences because it's creative. When it's creative, what makes it so unique and what makes it so individual is not just what you've done and what you've created, but it's also the little flaws, the little imperfections. If you're talented, the imperfections are almost more important and more telling and sometimes more beautiful than the perfections. my esteemed music teacher told me of an experiment that they did to try and work out perfect harmony for various pieces of Bach using a computer. So they put into the computer, they fed into the computer all the rules and laws of harmony. They fed in the melodies, the basic melodies, and they went through all the different variations that the computer could produce of different levels of perfection in harmonic production. And Bach's wasn't the most perfect one. The computer produced a more perfect harmony system than Bach himself, and was clearly mathematically right. When they looked at the computer's version, it was correct, it was musically and mathematically right. When they compared it with Bach, Bach was different. And then they played the computer's version, and it sounded too terrible for words. It was mathematically perfect, but it wasn't Bach. It didn't have the brilliance and the genius and the sparkle of Bach. We'll describe a little bit later why that is. But be that as it may, for the moment, understand that sometimes the brilliance of creativity lies not in its perfection, but also in its imperfection. We will understand that later on. And that's where the individuality lies. To be able to deviate from perfection and get away with it, enhancing what you're doing, never mind not detracting, for that you need genius. Anybody can paint a room, can come in and paint the whole room white, and the room will look alright. And if they want to be really daring, they can paint it some other color. And if they really want to be daring, they can paint it several other colors. But they'll check up, they'll ask an interior decorator what colors clash with each other. So they don't paint red and orange, for example, if that's what clashes with each other. Then paint green and blue. So he'll paint different colors. He'll paint brown and cream and things like that. So he knows he's on safe ground. Fine, you don't have to be a genius for that. You need a genius to dafka paint the blue and the green. To dafka paint the orange and the red. And use the very clash to highlight the effect. And to make it even better than it could have been by following the laws of color, aesthetics and harmony. That genius of creation everybody has. In some area or another, that talent, that ability, everybody has. And everybody can use and everybody can find. And it's in doing that that he really expresses in his individuality. When you walk into a room that has these clashing colors and you find, my goodness, you know, how would you have thought of doing such a thing and getting away with it? Then you realize only that person could have done it. Nobody else could have done it. When you listen to a piece of music and you hear two chords being played simultaneously that according to all the laws of music should never be played simultaneously because they're completely discordant and unharmonious. And you listen to it and it enhances the piece rather than detracts from the piece. You say, that's a genius. Just to play a piece in accordance with its musical harmony and with its perfect rhythm, for that one doesn't have to be a genius. The problem is that creation is no longer possible, really. Let me put it to you this way. The world's material world is divided into several categories, and two of the Kabbalistic categories into which they are divided is what we call the world of the Chomer, the world of matter, and the second one, the world of Tzura, the world of form. The world of matter is the matter out of which the world is made, the elements, the various molecules that form the various substances that we have, water and earth and wood and grass and air and stone and brick, glass, this is all Chomer. That's all part of the material world. That's the matter from which the world is made. Now in the area of Chomer, in the area of matter, creation is no longer possible. There was only once creation in the area of Chomer. That was during the 6 days of creation, and there's only one who's ever been created in the area of Chomer, and that's the Ribbono Shel Olam, and we today are unable, ever for that matter, have been unable to be creative in the area of matter. We can't create new matter. We can't create new stuff. What's in the world is in the world, and that's it. Finished. There's not going to be any more, there's not going to be any less. But in the area of tsura, in the area of form, we can be creative. And it's really only in the area of form that human beings have ever been creative. So, Rembrandt paints his picture again. Let's say he's painting a portrait. The chomer he's using, the material that he's using, is the model who's sitting for the portrait, his paints, his canvas, his brush. That's the chomer. The tsura is the painting. The form is what's really created. He hasn't created any new paint. He hasn't created a new canvas. He hasn't created a new model. It's all there before. He's not creative materially. He's not making anything new. Yet he's creating by realigning the various materials in a different way. He's creating a portrait. And it's not just the realigning of the materials. It's something a little bit more than that. When one talks about being creative in tsura, when one talks about being formatively creative, we're not talking merely about taking it and jumbling up in a chaotic sort of way and realigning and reorganizing the material. We're talking about reorganizing the material in a way that demonstrates that Rembrandt has seen something in that material that we didn't see, that we missed. Michelangelo looks at a block of marble. And we look at the block of marble. We see a block of marble. He doesn't. He sees something else. And his eyes start glowing and he starts getting ecstatic. And he can't sleep at night because he's thinking of this block of marble. We just walked past it. We hardly noticed it. It was a nuisance. It was in our way. We had to walk past it. We had to deviate to get around it. And early the next morning, right after sunrise, Michelangelo is onto his donkey and he's back to go and have a look at the marble again. He stands there in awe, this big block of stone. And he looks at it and he's absolute ecstasy, and this glaze over his eyes as he's looking at what's going on. And what does he then do? He takes his chisel, and what's the purpose of taking the chisel? To knock away that part of the marble which is obscuring the vision that he's got from us. That's all he's doing. He wants to show you what he saw in the marble. He saw Moses in the marble before he started. He looked at that piece of marble and he saw Moses. He knows you can't see it. Because there are all sorts of other tusks there apart from the Moses. There are all sorts of, the marble isn't cut as it should be. So he just knocks the pieces away. He chisels away until he's knocked everything distracting away and he's left for you that he noticed in it. That's what being formatively creative is. That's what's being creative in form, being creative in tsura. Also in Kabbalah we call the first form of creativity Bria. That's real creation. And Bria is a word which even in respect to God is used very, very seldom. Not even on each of the 6 days of creation. Only on 3 of those 6 days of creation. Rather on 2 of the 6 days of creation for 3 creations. Creation of the world, the initial creation of that first atom or molecule on the first day. Then the creation of animal, which was a jump forward. It wasn't an evolutionary creation. Up till the animal, it was evolutionary. But from the animal, there was some new aspect. There was a new Bria. And then again, you had an evolutionary period until the creation of man, which was again not evolutionary. And once again, you had the word Bria being used. So there were 3 creations in terms of material creation, in terms of Bria. And for being creative in form, we use the word Yetzira from Tsura. To form, which also means to create, but it's not to create ab initio. It's not to take something that didn't exist before and make it exist, but rather to create a concept by reorganizing material. And what I've said to you now is that you're not really creating the concept, you are revealing the concept. The concept's there. That Moses was in that block of stone. Michelangelo noticed it. That's all. And he knocked away everything that was obscuring that the vision of that Moses from your eyes so that you could see it too. That's what an artist is. And that's what real individuality is. To see something in its raw state and see more than others are able to see. If you can't see more than others are able to see in its raw state, you're not an individual, you're not different to anybody else. An individual is a man who can look at something in its raw state, whether it's a piece of material, or it's a tree, or it's another human being, and he can see what can be done with this object. He can see what lies inside, he's perceiving straight through to the neshama of the object, he's looking through to the soul of the object. And he understands and sees something there which is much greater than the mere little appearance that everybody else is noticing. And then he sets about actually revealing that pnimius, revealing that inwardness from the object and making it available for anybody else to notice and to observe too. When sacrifices were brought in the Beis HaMikdash, there was really the only form of self-expression was in selection. You couldn't do anything. You brought an animal. Who made the animal? God made the animal. That's all. All you could do, the only way you could really express your individuality, was by choosing which animal to bring as the carbon. And you chose the best that you could. So it was a qualitative value judgment. And through your qualitative value judgment, you could express yourself a little bit. With one exception, and that's the sacrifice of the Bikurim. It wasn't really a sacrifice, it was the bringing of the first fruits to the Kohen in the Beis HaMikdash. That was a slight exception. Because there too, on the one hand, you brought the fruits, and the fruits was merely just a selection process. God made the fruits, not you. You merely selected which fruits to bring to the Beis HaMikdash. But there's one difference in the case of the fruits that we don't have in the other cases, and that is that which we spoke about last night, where it says in the Sedra today, the lokach ha-kohen ha-tene miyodecho v'inicho lifnei mizbach Hashem elokecho, and the Kohen will take the basket from your hands and place it on the next to the altar of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So what is the Kohen taking? The basket. Here you've got another choice too. You've got a choice not only of what fruit you're going to bring, but also you've got the opportunity to choose in what container you're going to bring the fruit to the Mizbach, to the Beis HaMikdash. That's another choice. And here we have the Sifri, which tells us something very beautiful. And that is, so imagine now you're going to bring your first fruits to the Beis HaMikdash, and you've got to buy a container for it. And they would want a new container for it. So what would you do? A brown paper bag you wouldn't buy. A basket, pass me. You'd go, you'd buy gold, silver, gold plate at least, if you couldn't afford gold. A real nice stainless steel design if you couldn't afford either of those. Crystal glass, something very special you would buy. And what happens if you couldn't afford that? If you couldn't afford gold and you couldn't afford silver, and you couldn't afford crystal and you couldn't afford some nice design, nicely designed stainless steel, and you didn't want to bring something cheap and ugly, what would you do? Says the Sifri, you would make your own basket. You couldn't make your own gold bowl, and you couldn't make your own crystal glass, but you could make a basket. And in fact, it was the baskets which the Kohen used to take and keep that constituted part of the bringing of the Bikurim. Whereas if you did bring a glass or a gold or a silver bowl, the Kohen used to empty out the fruits and give you back the bowl. If you bring a gold or a silver bowl, it's all the same creative process. You selected the fruits and you selected the bowl. Well, selecting a bowl is not part of the Bikurim process. You were asked to bring fruits, not bowls. But where you selected the fruit and you made the basket, that's different. That's something you've made with your own sweat and toil, with your own hands, b'yagia kapecho. That's something you designed and you made. That's something which is precious to the Ribbono Shel Olam. It doesn't matter how cheap it is. Nothing you make yourself is cheap. Everything you make yourself requires your lifetime's experience, because in every bit of creation, your total personality is injected. Whatever you make, if it's something real, that which you make contains everything that you have. And so nothing that you make is cheap, and nothing that you make is ugly. Whatever you make is precious to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that becomes part of the Bikurim. And here we see these two types of expression of individuality coming together in the only sacrifice, the only korban. You select the fruit and you make the basket. And that together forms the Bikurim sacrifice. And what does it say? It doesn't say Velokach HaKohen HaBikurim MiYodecha, and the Kohen takes the fruit from your hand, although the fruit is the main part of the whole thing. But it doesn't say that. It says Velokach HaKohen HaTene MiYodecha. The Kohen takes the basket. That's what fascinates him. That's what he's really taking, and he's taking it because it's MiYodecha, because it's from your hand. You made that basket. That's why he's taking it, and that's why it's precious to the Beis HaMikdash. That's why it's precious to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the end of the first part of the shiur. Second part of the shiur. There's certain things that get people excited. And primarily what it is that gets people excited is anything that's new, anything that's unusual, anything that's unexpected, that's a surprise. Imagine if every morning at 10:30 a.m. the Red Sea split for half an hour and then closed again. Would it be a miracle? Would it even be written in the Torah? Nothing at all. It would be taken quite for granted. And it's unlikely that tourists to Egypt would even make an effort to go and see the Red Sea splitting. Maybe some are very enterprising and have got a bit of extra time on their program. They would rather go and see the pyramids. Go and see the Red Sea splitting. It happens every day. The moment something happens every day, it becomes vochadik. It loses its fascination, and it doesn't turn people on anymore. That's human nature. It's part of the tragedy of human nature, but it is human nature. Imagine the sun didn't go around, or the earth didn't go around the sun. Imagine the sun was always stationary. It was always daytime. The sun was in a particular spot. And all of a sudden, one day we look up and we see the sun's moved. It wasn't where it was a few moments ago. We must be going with sugar. For centuries the sun's been there, and it's not quite there anymore. And we look, and the sun's not moving. We go inside, we carry on with a shear. Somebody says, hey, it's again, it's not where it was. We come out, we look again, it's just minutely not where it was, but we begin to convince ourselves that we're all going a little mashuga, and we carry on learning. When we finish the shiur, we go outside, and now there's no question, the sun has moved. What's happening? People would be fascinated. Scientists would be watching, trying to understand. People would be excited. Everybody would stand and watch and look. Imagine the sun moves and moves and moves, and it gets over to the western horizon, and the place lights up in red. And the cloud formations, and it's all so red and so beautiful, and different shades of red. Can you imagine anybody sitting inside at that moment? Everybody would be standing and staring at this glorious sight. And poetry would be written, and music would be written, and paintings would be made. And people would be stimulated to great and high religious feeling. And finally the sun would set. We'd have darkness on the world. People would be terrified. They wouldn't know what to do with themselves. There would be this terrible atmosphere around the city, and people would be wailing and moaning and mourning. The end of the sun has disappeared. And imagine next morning when the sun rises. Again, you just see that glint of light on the east, and a little bit more, and the pink, and that brilliant red again on the east, and a new day. Can you imagine? People would go out of their minds. What would they only do? So why don't we go out of our minds? Because it happens every day, that's all. It's no less miraculous, and it's no less beautiful, and it's no less wonderful. It's just because it happens every day. And the moment something happens every day, we become totally desensitized to it. And it's one of the tragedies of human life, because what we only miss in terms of becoming bored with it is too tragic for words. In fact, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah tells delightful stories about Odom HaRishon. Can you imagine first man when it came nighttime? Well, there he was sitting. All of a sudden the sun starts going down and it starts getting dark, and he was convinced it was because he ate from the tree. He was absolutely sure. And he started mourning and praying and fasting. He didn't know what was going on. Next morning the sun rose again, and he realized it was a natural phenomenon. But then he started noticing something else. So alert and sharp was Odom HaRishon to everything that was happening around him. He started noticing that today was not quite as long as yesterday was. And he didn't have a watch. He felt something's wrong. And the next day, again, a little bit shorter. Oy, said Odom HaRishon, It's all very well, the sun goes down every night and comes up the next morning, but I'm getting less and less sun every day. What's going to happen if I project it a few months ahead? There'll be no day anymore. I'll be in perpetual darkness. And so it went, shorter and shorter days. Don't forget that Adam HaRishon was born at about this time of the year, which is the beginning of winter overseas. In Gan Eden it was the beginning of winter, the start of the shorter days. And the days went shorter and shorter and shorter until January time. When all of a sudden, towards the end of January, they started getting a little bit longer again. And Adam threw a party and he declared a Yom Tov and he brought sacrifices. And all cultures, all non-Jewish cultures, not only Christian but also Far Eastern and Indian and all sorts of funny cultures have celebrations during January, February time. Many of them call it New Year. The Gemara says all those celebrations have their origins in the celebrations of Adam HaRishon, when he noticed that the days were starting to become longer again and he realized this was a natural cycle. But one sees from this Gemara the fascination of these little things which we take so for granted, that no 2 days are the same length of time. But every day is a little bit different. Either the days are growing or the days are shrinking. The size of the moon is growing, the size of the moon is shrinking. The sun is moving. These are incredible phenomena that create the most beautiful feelings. And yet it leaves us stone cold. What we do notice is the change of seasons a little bit. When winter changes into spring, as it did most dramatically over the last 7 days, that we notice. That we feel. And there's a certain air of excitement around. One smells the fragrance of the blossoms, and there's the warmth, and people are becoming a little bit more relaxed. Somehow something's changed and one feels the newness, one feels a certain refreshing atmosphere in the air, because there's been a dramatic change after a long time of no summer. And when summer turns into winter or to autumn, again we notice that, we respond to it, we feel it. But the little subtle everyday changes that we don't notice. And I used to think that that was wrong, that it was just bad training and desensitized the neshom gets excited at new things. And I've changed my mind. I think that I was wrong. That it's inherent of the concept of emotional excitement that there's only one thing that can make a person excited, and that is something new. There's nothing else that can make a person excited. And that's why I always describe the narrow line that exists between teaching and entertaining. Now, what does an entertainer have to do? He has to keep telling the new jokes so that the people listen and they are entertained. He's got to keep them stimulated with new things. If he repeats the same joke twice, nobody laughs. And then he's not a good entertainer. And in teaching, there's a little bit of that too. If I would get somebody else to give the shiur on Motzei Shabbos, even if the shiur wasn't even as good as mine, if a mind any better than that, everybody would be listening. Everybody would be silent and nobody would fall asleep. It's new, it's different. But you could have Rabbi Akiva, as we have reported in the Gemara itself. Can you imagine what we would do to hear a shiur from a Rabbi Akiva, from a Rabbi Meir, from a Rabbi Tarfon, from a Rabbi Shimon? They used to have to tell jokes in the middle of their shiur to wake their Talmidim up. Can you imagine a Talmid falling asleep in front of Rabbi Akiva? Yes, I can. If they heard shiurim from Rabbi Akiva day in and day out, I assure you they fell asleep. When it's not new, it loses its fascination. And Rashi tells us in the Sedra, Hayom hazeh Hashem Elokecha metzavcho la'asos et hachukim o'ele ve'et hamishpotim v'shomarto v'asiso esam b'chol levavcho v'chol nafshecho. Today, this day, Hashem, your God, has commanded you to do these laws and to keep these mishpotim. You should keep them carefully with all your heart and with all your soul. Says Rashi, Hayom hazeh Hashem Elokecha metzavcho, bechol yom yehu beinecho chadoshim. Each day the Torah should be new to you. Every mitzvah should have the excitement of novelty to you. That's the proof that this is correct, that the only thing that excites you is something new. Says Rashi, the only way you can get excited with Torah is if it's new. So pretend that it's new. Strange. As if you've just been commanded that mitzvah. Have that air of excitement, have that air of fascination and surprise that it draws you in and turns you on. Every day. Well, we have to play games and pretend that things that are old are really new. It's not really like that. And here we come to the third part of the shiur. In terms of Chomer, in terms of material, Ein Chadash Tachat HaShemesh, says Kohelet, there is nothing new. Let's get that disturbing fact right. There is nothing new. All the material that will be created was created. It was created during the 6 days of creation. You want new things, you won't find them on this world. You want new things, go to some other world. Go to Mars. There you'll find things that you didn't see before. But Tachas HaShemesh, and if Mars, maybe you also won't find so much new. You might have to go to some system outside our solar system. If you're looking in our area here, Tachas HaShemesh, if you're looking within the sphere of influence of the sun, says Kohelet, Ein Chadash, you won't find anything new. It's all been there before. That exists in Torah too. The whole Torah was given at Mount Sinai. Not only was the whole Torah given at Mount Sinai, but Moshe was shown a videotape on which every shiur in Torah that was ever to be given, Moshe saw it all. And he watched every person's shiur. And he got very excited when it came to Rabbi Akiva, by the way. Very excited. He watched everybody right through to the present generation and future generations. And not only that, but every kasha that a little cheder child asked was also all part of that same Torah. It was all there. The Torah, the totality of the Torah which is ever going to be developed, was already developed at Har Sinai. There's nothing new in Torah. So I ask you, what is Rashi asking us to do? Not only is it difficult to make these dinim new, but there is nothing new in Torah. It's all been said already. What are you going to do to get excited about it? What is it that makes one excited? It's the unexpected. For example, take music as an example. If I played one note on an electric organ continuously, a very beautiful note, an E or an E flat or a D, played it, and you just heard this continuously, that doesn't turn anybody on. Doesn't get anybody excited. Play an E, play an F, play a G, play an A, and leave it on continuously. Doesn't get anybody excited. So after a while you can say, my goodness, I've played each note on the keyboard and left each note on for an hour and nobody got excited. So what's there in music? It's a different combination. So you'll try it in a different order. Still nobody will get excited. So you'll realize that maybe it was too monotonous. So you don't play it continuously for an hour. You play da 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 for an hour. People go meshuggah, they walk out. And you say, now what can be wrong? You realize there's got to be variation. So you start playing scales. Scales, scales, hours and hours of scales, all the scales, up and down. Still people walk out. What's wrong? What's going on? What's the problem? You're taking all the musical notes that they are, you're playing them in all their different keys, and still nobody likes it. So you get a little bit wiser and you start playing arpeggios in different keys. For the first couple of moments, people's interest lasts a little bit longer, and still you find them walking out after a few minutes. They're no longer interested. Then you think, this is no good. So you compose a piece, and still you find people are walking out. What is it that creates or retains a fascination in a musical piece? A composer will start his piece with a particular chord. Makes no difference what chord it is. It's equally uninteresting, really. It might be slightly sophisticated, but let's take an ordinary piece of music, so a chord starts. You listen. Nothing to get excited about. And you know, in fact, what the next note is likely to be. Because there are not many choices. Having started your first chord at a particular place, it's got to be one of a couple of things. And once he's played his second note, you know what his third note has to be. And you listen, and you're starting to get bored. And then you hear it repeated. Those three notes are now repeated, exactly the same but by different instruments. Well, so now you know he's Kunz, so he's going to repeat it a third time again by different instruments, which he does. Does it the three chords, and now a third time. Starts again. So you know exactly what's going to happen. He started with the strings, and he then went to the woods, and now he's on the brass, and then he's going to be on the double bass. The kachava, the fourth time, the double basses come in, and they start with exactly the same thing, except the third note is half a note lower. And that shocks you. Now what's he going to do? How's he going to get back? He switched keys. And he's playing those same things over and over again, starting again at the violin, but it's in a different key. That is brilliant. to make that jump and to make that switch, and again he catches you. And he throws something else in which is unexpected. And he leaves a note out and he takes you too far and he drops you too low. And then he's got you in his hand because you don't know what's coming next. And it's there that you find the brilliance of the Creator. And that's what makes one emotionally excited. The unexpected. But it's got to be the unexpected that works. It can't be the unexpected that doesn't work. It has to be the unexpected. Firstly, it can't be chaos. So you'll say, right, so just go and bang your cans on the keyboard and whatever comes out will make a big surprise because I don't know myself what I'm going to play. That doesn't work either. Because then the system is chaos and one becomes bored. What creates, what retains interest is where you've got a system and there are brilliant deviations from the system. When you're expecting the next note and what you expect is not what you hear. And even stranger, what you were expecting was the most perfect there could be. It had to be that. And he lets you down. He plays a note which is not as perfect as the one you know there should be there, and yet it sounds better. And you say, that only Beethoven could do. Nobody else could do that. That's the brilliance of Yetzirah, that's the brilliance of creation, and that's the talent. And now you want to listen to the next time he's going to do it again. Emotionally, we only get excited when we notice humanity, or more than humanity, because this isn't humanity. This is the closest we can come to godliness, because it's the closest we can come to creation. You can't create matter, but you can create in terms of Yetzirah, and that's the closest we can come to godly creativeness. And experiencing that creativeness is the closest we can come to experiencing the creativeness of godliness. Therefore, when one does experience it, what one is experiencing is a ruchnius. One is experiencing a spirituality. And that drives one emotionally. That touches one emotionally. That turns one on emotionally. Now, one can have a piece of information. One can have a piece of information, or let's say a piece of information can have its chomer, it has its material, and it has its tzura. It has the creative form in which it's presented, either by you or by somebody else. For example, I say to you that the sun is 90 million miles away from the earth, or whatever it is. So you know it. And I say, can you repeat that? You say, yes, the sun is 90 million miles away from the earth. And I say, right, try and remember that, because I'm going to ask you again tomorrow. And I wake you up early the next morning, I say, how far is the sun from the earth? You say, 90 million miles. I say, beautiful, fantastic. But does that mean anything to you? Imagine you don't know what a mile is. You don't know how long a mile is. You've never walked out of your house. You don't know what a mile is. But like the Africans talk in terms of, it is 5 days walking, or it is 100 days by foot, or it is 200 days by donkey. That's how they express distance. Say a person, an African who doesn't understand miles, and you've taught him like a parrot that the sun is 90 million miles away from the earth, and he now knows it, it means nothing. Ask him then, which is further, the sun or Park Station? And look at you blankly, I don't know. He'll ask you, how many miles is Park Station? If you'll tell him, he'll be able to make a calculation and tell you which one is further. But he doesn't have a feeling of what it's all about. And you'll wonder, why don't you get excited? You'll tell him the next day, you know. The Americans sent a rocket and it went from here to Saturn. And I don't know, is Saturn further away or it wasn't further away? I don't know at that particular time of the year. But assuming that it's further, and you'll say, you know, the sun was 90 million miles away. This was even further. And they sent this rocket off from America and it passed right past Saturn and it took photographs. You look at you and say, yes, and he'll repeat it to you. The Americans sent a rocket and went to Saturn. And you'll say, don't you get excited at that? Don't you understand what it is? And he looks at you blankly. What's gone wrong? He knows all the facts. You've given him all the information and he's not excited. He's not excited because he doesn't see the tzura. He sees the chomer, he sees the wood, but he doesn't see that the wood is made into a table. He doesn't see it's a piece of antique furniture. To him, a table is something that you chop up. That piece of antique is something that you chop up when you're cold and you put it into the fire to make you warm. It's wood. He doesn't understand what beauty it is. Or you'll take a log which has been carved by Michelangelo, but it looks like a log, just has the most beautiful carvings on it. And he'll go and he'll throw it into his fireplace. It's wood. He won't understand why you get so excited and why it's worth such a lot of money. He doesn't see the tsurah, he only sees the khumar. He only sees what the stuff is made from, not what it is. What it is lies in the tsurah, not in the khumar. In Torah you've got the same situation. With any knowledge and information you've got the same. Khumar, I'll give you another example of it in Halacha. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Hei, says the following. There's discussion about whether you can start a court case on Friday. And the Gemara concludes that you can't start a court case on Friday because there's no time to really finish everything up. The one suggestion is, let's start on Friday and we'll carry on Sunday. Having cast out all sorts of other alternatives, the Gemara now comes to the final suggestion, let's start on Friday and we'll stop for Shabbos and we'll carry on Sunday. Says the Gemara, no, min shuta mayu, by Sunday the Dayonim have forgotten the reasoning of their arguments. Ask the Gemara, afagav the shnei sofei ha-dayonim oimdim lifneim v'kosvim divrei ha-mezakim v'divrei ha-mechayvim? There's nothing that the Dayonim cannot remember. Let them refer to their records. Come Sunday morning, they sit down, they'll read through the records, they'll listen to the transcripts, they'll go through the whole business, and they'll carry on Sunday, says the Gemara. Nehi debepume katvin. It's true that the mouth has been written. Liba de inshi, inshi. The heart of a man forgets. Says Rashi. Liba de inshi, inshi. Liba de inshi, loy katvi. The heart of a man cannot write. Even though he remembers the principles of his arguments, he forgets that touch of brilliance which made him so satisfied with a particular argument. And he can't redo it the same way. That break of a Shabbos has not left him with any material missing. There's no factual knowledge that he had on Friday which he doesn't have on Sunday. It's all before him, it's all written down, every word. But there's just that feeling when it clicked, when he saw the brilliance of an argument and the correctness and truth of an argument, and there was that flash in his face. That's missing now, that he doesn't have. That's something which in every idea, in every piece of information, the important part is not just the fact, because the fact on its own is empty, it's sometimes meaningless, and it's always misleading. The important thing is to understand the Yishuv Hatam, right down to the bottom, to see the Tzura. The interesting thing with the Tzura is that unlike the form, unlike the Chomer, if you're given a fact today and you remember that fact tomorrow and next year, you don't remember it any differently, you don't understand it any differently, you don't see it any differently. If you understand the tsura, if you understand the deep meaning that lies behind it, if you understand the real message, if you see the Moses inside the marble, as you get older, every day, as you get more mature, you see new shades, you see it in different light, in the light of your new experiences. The concept grows with you. Your Yiddishkeit or your profession or whatever it is grows with you, provided you're looking at it artistically, provided you're looking at it with a mind, with an intellect, and that you're not just looking at it on the surface. When you're a child, you learn Ashra Yoshe Besecha Od Yaluchu Selah, and you can translate it. Happy is the man who dwells in your house, who will carry on praising you forever and ever. Beautiful, lovely, you know it. And if I ask you today and I say translate for me the first words of Ashra, you'll translate it the same way. And I said, that's how you translated it 20 years ago. You said, it's the same passage. Why should I translate it any different? Surely it's different to you? What does Ashrei mean? What does Oysher mean? Does the concept of Oysher, of wealth and happiness, wealth in the metaphorical sense, because financial wealth is a different word altogether, Oysher in the happiness in the and wealth in the metaphorical sense, does that mean the same to you now as it meant when you were a kid, a 5-year-old kid? That you translate it the same and feel it the same and govern it the same? Ashrei, it's a new word, it's a new concept. Yoshve, who dwell. What Yishuv is.
when you were small, dwelling, mean dwelling, living. Now, yeshuv, there's the concept of yeshuv hadas, of dwelling in a peaceful sort of way, with menuchas nefesh, with a broad and relaxed mind and attitude. There's a concept of yeshiva, comes from the word yoshev. So that now all of a sudden you're saying ashrei, and your emotional understanding of the happiness described by the word ashrei is completely different. And yeshvei is no longer the yeshvei, just people sitting or dwelling. Now you think of yeshvei, you think of yeshivas. Beisecho, in your houses. What are your houses? When you were a kid, you thought of a whole lot of houses. Now, a Beis Hashem, what is a Beis Hashem? You've learnt about what a Beis HaMikdash is. You know what a Beis HaMikdash is. You know what a yeshiva is. You know what a Talmud Torah is. You know what a Beis HaMedrash is. Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecho. It's a different concept, a different phrase. Oyd Yalalu Choselo. They'll carry on praising you, but now Yalalu. There are different kinds of praise. There's Shvach and there's Tehillah. All different kinds of praise. Yehalelucho is one particular facet of praise which you now understand. It's a different world because you've grown. If you see the Moses in the marble. But if you're looking at Asher, Yeshe, Besecho, Yehalelucho, Selah, and all you see is the marble, it will look the same today as it looked 30 years ago. The marble doesn't change. You say, Aleinu l'shabeach la'adoin hakol. What that phrase means, if you think about it. Aleinu, we are obligated. It is upon us. The concept of a chiyuv, of an obligation. L'shabeach, yeah, you've got a different form of praise. It's not the same as Yehalelucho Tzela. This is shvach, l'shabeach. What's the difference? Why does it use the Yehalelucho in the one case and Yeshabchucho in the other? Aleinu l'shabeach la'adoin hakol. An adoin, a master, an owner of everything. What does ownership mean? You start thinking of all your Gemaras, Bava Metzia, Bava Kama, Bava Basra, concepts of ownership, concepts of Baalus, concepts of Adnus, a master over a servant. Adon HaKol, the owner, the master of everything. Your concept of Kol should have changed. Kol is now universal, not just your little place. If you're growing. And if you see the Moses in the marble. If you see the marble, it means the same. Aleinu means the same, Ashrei means the same, Shema means the same, Shabbos means the same, Kiddush means the same, Havdalah means the same, you mean the same, your wife means the same, your parents mean the same, your children mean the same. And there's no development, no growth, whatever. It's only when one's able to relate to a concept in its form of Tzura, to see the Yetzira, not just to see the Chomer, but to see the brilliance of creation that lies behind it, that you're able to find something new. You can learn the same Pasuk of Chumash over and over again. As long as you're looking at Yetzirah, each time you'll find a new aspect. Just a new shade of meaning, but that changes everything. A new angle. And a new little link which you just didn't notice before. And it changes the meaning of all your Yiddishkeit, never mind of that one Pasuk. If you really understand and if you're really working on it. But that needs application. And that needs effort. The Talmud Rav writes that he used to wonder and he used to discuss with his senior Talmidim why it is that he gives a shir and he develops a chiddush, he develops an idea and he builds it up and he presents it and comes the punchline and he puts it forward and he looks around the shir and he sees some people's faces are blazing. Almost the horns of light are just about coming out of them like from Moshe. They're just in another world. The eyes are on fire with delight. And they're almost floating on top of their chairs. And he looks at others, and they're sitting there with pretty glum, dull faces. And he looks at others, and they're sleeping. He looks around, he says, they're all equally intelligent. It's not a measure of intelligence. So he once asked his comedian, what is it? Why do they get excited, and they're dull, and they're asleep? So I said, no, they aren't emotional. No, an emotional person gets excited. A person is cold and unemotional, doesn't get excited. Says the Talmud Rav, that's not right. Emotion is not something that just gets turned on and off. Emotional is something when you notice the unexpected. Emotional, you get emotional when you're excited by something which deviates from what you would predict, and there's brilliance lying in that deviation. But for that, you've got to look below the Chomer. And if you look at all the Rembrandts lining the wall, and you say, well, it's canvas with paint, canvas with paint. All of them, canvas and paint on them, canvas and paint. In this whole gallery, do they have nothing but canvas and paint? Oh, finally you'll see a pestle there, you'll see an idol standing. No, oh, this is something different for a change. And you go to another place, idols, idols, idols. All they've got is idols over here. Sure, that's what it looks like if you look at them. Unless you look at the nuances of each one to see the differences and to see where each one expresses its individuality and its brilliance. You have one Talmud, listens to a shir, and he hears the piece of Gemara, he knows the Gemara. The Kashi of Tosfos, he knows the Tosfos. An answer of the Rambam, he knows the Rambam. A question on the Rambam, he knows the question. An answer on the question, he thought of that answer too. That's the shir. He missed one form of presentation. Just the way that answer was worded. Where exactly it came in. The stress that was put on a particular word, which created the individuality of that particular shir that the Telzer Rav might have been giving. That he missed because he was looking at the chomer, he was looking at the material, without in any way even noticing the yetzirah, the creative brilliance, lying behind the organization of the material to show what's really there. There's a delightful Yerushalmi that tells us part of this is brought in our Gemara too, and it's brought in short, and the full story is very delightful. This is in Beta, the fifth Perek, Halacha Beis. Rebbe had a mace of the Rabbi Shimon Berei. Rebbe was having dinner, it was actually a wedding, of his son, Rabbi Shimon Berei. It was Shabbos. Might have been Sheva Brochus or the wedding itself. Vavu metapchin la'chore yedehun b'shuvte. And on Shabbos they were clapping hands, but they were clapping with the back of their hands. You're not allowed to clap hands on Shabbos like this, unless it's in the Dvar Mitzvah. But to clap with a shino, you're allowed to. So they were clapping their hands like this. And they were singing. Can you imagine that wedding? Rebbe, Rabbi Shimon Berebbe. Ovar Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was walking past the hall. V'shoma kalon, and he heard these people inside clapping. Omar, he shouted into the hall, Rabbi Seinu, Hutra HaShabbos. Is Shabbos now Mutu? You don't have to worry about the dinim on Shabbos. Shoma Rabbi Kale, Rabbi heard the voice of Rabbi Meir. Omar, and he said, Mi hu zeh shobolir doiseinu besoich beiseinu. Who is this that is prying into our business inside our house? Should have lived in Johannesburg. Can you imagine what he would have said then? What business is this? What we're doing here on Shabbos? None of his business. Didn't even bother to answer him that they were clapping on the back of his hand, of their hands. It's none of his business. Keep out. Not only that. Shomer Rabbi Meir kalev v'orak. Rabbi Meir heard there was Rebbe inside there, and he started running down the road. That you can't imagine. He didn't realize what he'd done. He thought it was just some ordinary people, and they were clapping on Shabbos. So he shouted, "Shabbos, Shabbos!" Says Rebbe, "What are you talking about? Get out, get him." Nafkin pri batre mifri. So out ran all the guests at the wedding, and they started chasing down the road after Rabbi Meir. They weren't going to let Rabbi Meir get away with this. None of his business to interfere in Rebbe's home. Rebbe went to the window to watch. Afrach ravcha pikaile mi al kadle de Rabbi Meir. The wind, as Rabbi Meir was running for his life, loosened the scarf around his neck and it blew off. Rebbe was looking at all this down the road. He was watching in delight to see Rabbi Meir flee down the road with his batch of Talmidim running after him. And he saw the scarf fall off and he saw the back of Rabbi Meir's neck. Omar, lo zachis ono lo raisa elo begin de chami kadle de Rabbi Meir min acheira. He said, any greatness I subsequently achieved in Torah was because I caught a glimpse of Rabbi Meir's neck at the back. That gave me insight which affected everything else that I achieved in Torah later on. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Trehen Amrin. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish both said, Anan lo zachin and lo araisa, the only reason we made progress in Torah, elo begin de chaminan et bote de Rebbe min gukinan dideh, is because we saw the fingers of Rebbe sticking out of his sleeve. That's what taught us all the Torah we know. What are they saying? What do they mean? What Torah can you learn by seeing the back of Rabbi Meir's neck? What Torah can you learn by seeing the pinky of Rebbe? What does it mean? Torah to learn is nothing. You can learn Torah from art scrolls. You can learn Torah from books. but it won't give you anything. The Torah which those judges knew on Friday, all the decisions, all the arguments, everything that they had that wasn't sufficient to make a decision on Sunday. Because to know what you're talking about and to make a Torah decision, it's not just the chomer of Torah you need. You need the tzura of Torah. You need the creative side of Torah. You need to see the Moses inside the marble. The Torah is not the marble, the Torah is the Moses. That's what you've got to be able to see. And that you can't learn in a book. And that you can't get off a tape recorder. And that you can't get from notes and from records. And that you can't even get from hearing shiurim. That you can only get from watching in action. You've got to see. You've got to see the Torah being lived. And then even just the back of Rabbi Meir's neck, what could he have seen that gave him so much Torah? Maybe the way a man holds his head as he's running down the street. I don't know, the way he retained his dignity. Can you imagine Rabbi Meir fleeing from this rabble who were out to get him? Obviously he still ran away with dignity and with nobility. But something about the way he held his neck, which taught Rabbi everything he later knew in terms of the tzura of Torah, of the form of the neshama of Torah, not just of the content of Torah. One then understands the last Rashi on the Sedra that I want to bring you this evening. God says to the, Moshe says to the people of Israel, just as they are about to enter the land of Israel, 40 years after having received the Torah, V'loy notzon Hashem lochem leiv lodas ve'naim liros v'znaim lishma'a da yom hazeh. Up till now, God didn't give you a heart to understand and eyes to see and ears to hear until this day. So God didn't expect all that much from you. But now you've got your eyes, and you've got your ears, and you've got your heart. Now God's going to expect an awful lot from you. Be careful to keep the Torah meticulously. Says Rashi, quoting a Gemara in Avodah Zorah, She'ein odom oimeid al soif da'atoi shel rabbi v'chochmas mishnosoi ad aboim shona. It takes 40 years to understand what your teacher is talking about. That Gemara in Avodah Zorah used to amaze me for years and years. I could never understand it. 40 years to understand what your teacher is talking about? No, understand if your teacher is good, it takes a couple of years. But 40 years? And 40 years you've already forgotten what your teacher told you, never mind that you begin to understand. All you can possibly hear while he's talking, and in the years immediately following that, is what he said. But what he said you don't need him for. What he said you can get from a tape recorder. What he said you can get from notes, you can get from a book. That's not the ikkah. The ikkah lies in what lies behind it in the tzura. To begin to see the outlines of the Moses inside the marble, that takes 40 years of experience. And only after 40 years of maturing, of dwelling on it, of repeating it, of trying it from different angles, of living in accordance with it, only then does it begin to sink in. And do you begin to understand what the man was really talking about and what was really coming across? What one sees here is a whole attitude to learning, not just learning Torah, to learning life. And an attitude to living it. Unfortunately, it's true that we only get emotional about things that are new. So we have two options in front of us. Either look for new things all the time and do new things and try and get emotional in a cheap sort of way. Or find the newness in everything. But to find the newness in everything, you need to be relating to its tzura, not to its chomer. To be able to get excited when you hear the same thing a second time, you have to be relating to its essence. And as you've developed and progressed, your understanding of its essence also develops and progresses. And you hear it the second time, and it doesn't mean the same thing as you heard it the first time. And you hear it the third time, and it doesn't mean the same thing as it meant the second time. As you're developing, so are your thoughts, and so is your understanding, and so is the angle at which you're approaching things developing at the same time. That's what Rashi means, B'chol yom yu be'necho kechadoshim. It's Gemara. Every day the Torah should be to you as new. That the way you approach Torah is not just by approaching it in the sense of its chomer. And this explains, to those of you who haven't understood previously, why I'm so dead against learning Torah too quickly. That sounds a strange thing. What can be wrong with a man learning quickly? The quicker you learn, the better. you see a whole lot of marble chunks eventually. And that's what your Torah is. It becomes very heavy and very cheap. A lot of heavy stones that need to be pulled around. And you can't quite understand what Michelangelo gets so excited about. Because you look at them, they're really plain things, and each time you learn a new thing, it's another chunk of stone that you've got to handle and that you've got to deal with and you've got to relate to. Don't allow your progress in Chomer, don't allow your progress in being exposed to new material to go too far ahead of your ability to relate to its essence and to see the tzura, to see the form that lies beneath that. When one sees the form that lies beneath it, it becomes exciting, it becomes exhilarating, it becomes emotional, and it becomes easy. Easy to handle. As long as you don't see that surah, it's heavy. What is Shabbos? You're not allowed to do this, and you're not allowed to do that, and you're not allowed to do that. It's a bulk of stone, that's all. You finish with Shabbos, and then starts, well, it's Slichus week. You've got to do this, and you've got to do this, and you can't do that. And you finish with that, and it's Aseres Yemei Tshuva. And more things you can't do. And then it's Yom Kippur, and between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, other things that you're supposed to do. Sukkot comes over at the end of Sukkot, whew, you know, now we can relax. Is that Yiddishkeit? It should be, Sukkot is over. Ah, we're so nice. What are we going to do now till Pesach? How are we going to manage? We've had weeks of it, we've been spoiled. If you're relating to the Tzura, if you know what a Sukkah is, and you know what a Sukkot is, and what a Lulav is, and what an Esrog is, and what a Cholamoed is, and what an eating together in a sukkah is, and what an entertaining guests in a sukkah is, and what Hallel is, and what a Yom Kippur is, and Aseres Yemei Tshuva is, and a Rosh Hashanah is. Maybe the poor women, I keep on thinking that what they think Yom Tov is cooking. That's what Yom Tov is. It's terrible. But then I look at the men and I say, what do the men think Yom Tov is? Davening. I don't know which is more pleasant, it depends. They're both equally unpleasant if they're bulks of marble. And they're both equally pleasant if one sees the Moses inside the marble. And if one's exposed too quickly to too much marble without being taught how to see the Moses, what you have is a dreary, heavy, burdensome Yiddishkeit that starts bending your shoulders and breaking your back and starts making one feel negative towards the very things that are supposed to be making you feel positive. It's a slow process. It's the development of an art. It's the development of a skill. It's the development of ruchnius, of spirituality. It's the development of new eyes, new ears, and a new heart. The ability to see in ordinary things unordinary phenomena. To get excited about old things because one sees them not as old, but in each one sees something new. I would say a person who's unable to get excited at a sunset or at a sunrise is unable to start in Yiddishkeit yet. When we say Derech Eretz Kodma LaTorah, before you start Torah, just Derech Eretz, be a normal mensch. A normal mensch should get excited when he sees the sunrise. If he doesn't, there's something wrong. And if he can't get excited when he sees the sunrise because he's seen it before, how is he going to get excited when he says Kriya Shema twice a day his whole life? Every morning, every afternoon, the same Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu. How is he going to say it with any kind of excitement? Shmona Esra 3 times. Aleinu 3 times. Learning a piece of Gemara 100 times. How is he going to get excited with the same piece of Gemara over and over again? He won't. He doesn't stand a chance. Derech Eretz Kodma LaTorah, be a normal mensch. A normal mensch has to develop the ability to see through the marble and to see the Moses. And each time you go and look at that Moses in Rome, you see a different thing. You notice something different. It's not the same as looking at a piece of marble. Each time you see a new aspect of the brilliance of the Yotzer of that, of the man who formed it. And each time you see a sunrise and a sunset, or you hear a bird, or you look at a flower, you see a different aspect of the brilliance, kibiyachil, of the Yotzer Kol of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's how you build up an emunah, that's how you build up a belief in the Ribbono Shel Olam. Let's be careful as we approach Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that we don't see this merely as another Yom Tov, another Rosh Hashanah, comes around year after year, we had one last year, we have one this year, we'll have one next year, that we don't get dull and boring and bored, but that we find in everything that we do that little bit of newness and that little bit of specialness which keeps us fresh.